Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given right, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Ever, it's cities that are defining the future. The United Nations projects that by 2050, nearly 70% of the world's population will be city dwellers. As cities continue to grow, it has become increasingly vital to find better ways of managing these populations and the services they require. Densely populated cities consume two-thirds of the world's energy and produce a similar proportion of global carbon emissions. This places cities at the heart of the climate change discussion.
The question is, how can we develop an electrical infrastructure that's economical and maintains our quality of life? And then how can we integrate more renewable energy sources into that infrastructure so that we can radically reduce our impact on the environment? I know. Oof.
With cities growing, it's no surprise that they are looking to redefine their energy distribution systems. So, what needs to change anyways?
In the 20th century, the energy production landscape was traditionally dominated by gas and coal and was distributed via a centralized grid. Power flowed in one direction from plant to end user.
In recent years, the world has seen disastrous power outages. With recurring hurricanes, wildfires and storm surges, calls for new, more modern power grids are getting louder. So, what if power was local? In an intelligent power grid or smart grid, energy producers, storage and consumers are digitally linked. Supply and demand is coordinated through energy management systems and constant measurement of energy. This way, energy is produced, stored, and distributed more efficiently. Microgrids are the smallest units of smart grids. They are local energy systems which can protect communities or critical infrastructure from wider outages. Microgrid projects offer a glimpse into how locally distributed energy can improve system resilience.
There are projects all over the world, and one is here in Amsterdam. To be precise, it's in Beuksloterham in the north of the Dutch capital. Welcome to Schoonsrip, the sustainable floating community.
Schoonsrip is a floating complex with a current total of 47 households in 30 residential units. The team behind Schoonsrip aimed to create an urban ecosystem that addresses systematic causes of climate change with an intelligent energy system.
Today we're in the Schoonsrip community, and right now we're looking at the technical installations inside of the community center, which every single household at Schoonsrip has a similar setup.
Every household of Schoonsrip is equipped with a number of things, like solar panels and heat pumps.
And all of these systems are actually connected here to the My Power Grid energy management system. And that is in real time measuring what's happening within the household with its own solar production. But that's also communicating centrally with a cloud-based system that is getting data from all of the houses.
But the system doesn't only store the data. It takes the weather and solar information into account in order to optimize each household's energy production.
And so using that data, this computer is constantly processing, what should I do? Should I charge the battery? Should I discharge it? Should I store energy as heat using the heat pump? And so it's connected with these various devices here in order to enable the operation of the smart grid.
That box is Schoonsrip's connection to the public grid. And it does need that connection. During summer, the community could run self-sufficiently for quite some time. But it's tougher in winter, less sun, and more energy that is needed for heating. So far, so good from the technical side, but what is it like to live like this and to share all your data for everyone to see? That's what I asked Per. He has been living at Schoonsrip for a bit over a year.
Well, it has been debated, of course. Do we really want to have this in this way? And do we really want to share this data? Yep. And we know how important these data are for a bigger system, yeah, because we want to enroll this whole system in is not only this neighborhood, but all over the country, yeah, and even in European-wide, et cetera, et cetera. So we realize that it's needed to have a sort of open mind.
So what's next on the agenda for Schoonsrip?
The next step with this project is to actually connect Schoonsrip together with other communities in the area, setting up an entire district level smart grid where all of the communities and different households and businesses can connect to in order to, on one hand, exchange energy with each other, but also to be able to monetize their sources of flexibility to help balance the national network.
By the way, Schoonsrip works with a lot of open source technology. That way, other projects can use the technology and combine it with their own ideas.
I think somewhere in the coming years, you know, we'll see much more and more of these projects. And you can also see, I mean, we started, what I said, 10 years ago, and the more the technical stuff and were designed like 4 or 5 years ago. And you can, I mean, innovation is going very rapidly. So I think the next project will have even more smarter systems than we do.
Decentralizing energy production and making citizens play an active part in this is crucial for the energy transition. But there's certainly more to it. Already today, we are surrounded by smart energy elements. Sometimes more visible and sometimes less. Amsterdam is setting up smart lighting systems in different areas throughout the city. That means municipalities can control the intensity of streetlights depending on where they are located. Movement sensors ensure that streetlights reach their maximum intensity when people or vehicles pass them. They return to the lowest point when there's no one around.
A lot of these streetlights in Amsterdam are equipped with LED technology and are powered by solar panels and wind turbines. That way, they stay independent from the general power grid, which also saves money on wiring and infrastructure. Smart!
Police departments and traffic offices can also increase the maximum intensity of the streetlights in the event of an emergency. Examples like this prove that redefining energy use can go hand in hand with enhancing our quality of life.
Okay, one more thing. If we talk about smart energy, we obviously need to talk about cars.
Electric cars are an important part of decarbonization and air quality efforts, especially in cities. There are currently almost 200,000 electric vehicles in the Netherlands. That's a national market share between 10 and 15%. Electric car sales are expected to go up in the future. By 2030, the number will increase tenfold. While that's good news, it also means that a new problem arises. Handling the extra demand generated by all these energy-hungry cars is one of the key challenges in future cities. That's where smart charging comes into play.
So smart charging is steering your charging session, either delaying at what time your charging session starts or reducing the power output of your charging session. And this has many benefits, but the three most looked for are balancing the energy market, avoiding local net congestion, and thirdly, reducing the cost of charging your car.
Electric cars are often plugged in for a longer time than they actually need to be. With smart charging, cars can be plugged in, but charged when it's the most efficient, both cost and grid-wise. This is regulated via a cloud-based software, which analyzes information from the charging station in real time. If the grid works to capacity during the day, the software could decide to only charge the car during low demand periods at night. And smart charging allows for other features too, such as a two-way power flow.
Bidirectional charging allows you to further improve the added value of smart charging, because now you can not only delay the session, but you can also deliver back the energy at some point in time when, for instance, there is not enough energy available. And now you can deliver that energy from the battery pack in your car.
That way, citizens are no longer just energy consumers, but also producers. For all that to function properly, we need the right infrastructure.
Smart things don't necessarily have to look smart.
This is an electric charging station. Around 55,000 of these are all over the Netherlands, and the Dutch government aims to have around 1.8 million in the country by 2030. Quite a task. One of the people taking it on is Peter Looyestein. He is a project manager for MRA Electris, a non-profit government joint venture. He and others make sure that the charging infrastructure meets certain technological standards to cope with the expected rise in e-mobility. That includes only using renewable energy, minimizing waste during production, and maintaining the charging stations.
Looking at the energy usage of a common household, everybody would be driving an electric car in that household. The energy demand of such a household would double. If it would only double without smart charging, we're in quite a lot of problems. If we do smart charging, we can reduce that with a lot, and we can keep scaling up the energy transition and electromobility.
The energy transition requires fundamental structural changes in our existing energy systems. These have to happen on a local and global level. Either way, digitalization will play a decisive role in all that.
The vision for the future energy sector is a fully digitized system where all these kind of technologies are communicating with each other using smart algorithms, being able to actually manage the grid networks and the balance of supply and demand, using millions of distributed devices that communicate with each other and enable a much more efficient and affordable energy transition for all.
So the next guy is a guy called Adam Greenfield, who's at the London School of Economics. This is a presentation he did, I think, at the London School of Economics in 2020.
What I'm going to be speaking to you about today is an emergent subject of great interest to the planet's diverse urbanist communities, this notion of the smart city. The talk is called Another City is Possible, Networked Urbanism from Above and Below. And the primary point I want to make to you is that when considering the intersection of networked information technology and our cities, this notion of the smart city is terribly, terribly partial and incomplete and unsatisfactory. And I'd like to explore where the ideas behind this paradigm of the smart city come from so we can understand why I feel this way and maybe perhaps convince you of that viewpoint. I want to take a look at some recent visions of the urban future, visions that are bound up in development sites on Earth, places like Masdar in the United Arab Emirates, Songdo in the Republic of Korea, which is to say South Korea, and a very mysterious development in Portugal called Planet Valley, which has been produced and promoted primarily by an American company named Living Planet. These are a series of places on Earth. These are the canonical smart cities, the original smart cities. But if they constitute physical environments, sites, and terrains, they also constitute a discourse. Could I have these lights down a little bit? That would be really nice. They also constitute a discourse, a coherent and a contained body of thought and practice with some very, very deep valuations, priorities, and beliefs built into it. And given that I was trained as a literary theorist and a literary critic, I'd like to do a close reading of this discourse. I'd like to attempt a close reading of these sites and perhaps understand a little bit more about what those valuations, what those priorities, and what those beliefs are. We're going to be asking the following questions about these places. We're going to be asking, what are they? Where are they? For whom are they intended? By whom were they developed? And why? Why the smart city at this moment in history? Well, here's the what of things. The what is fairly straightforward. The proposition of the smart city is to embed networked informatics, which is to say digital networked information processing systems, in every object, surface, and relation of the city. So all of the structures and all of the infrastructures, all of the vehicles, all of the things that surround us in the built environment, and even our relations with one another and the natural world that take place in that environment. The who of the smart city is relatively easy to figure out. There is a series of corporate, large, enterprise-scale, international actors, global names we're all familiar with, like IBM and Cisco and Siemens, as well as some smaller concerns, like this American company, Living Planet, that I've described to you. And if we're going to learn more about the what, it's important to listen to the who. It's important to listen to these enterprises as they describe specifically what they think it is that the smart city is all about. IBM describes their urban initiative as technology that synchronizes and analyzes efforts among sectors and agencies. So not among us as people or as citizens, but among sectors and agencies as they happen, giving decision makers consolidated information that helps them anticipate problems and manage growth and development in a sustainable way that minimizes disruptions and helps increase prosperity for everyone. Well, I think we can all agree that the goal of prosperity for everyone is a valid goal, an ambitious goal, but something that we can all relate to. It's that minimizes disruptions that I want you to remember, because later on in the presentation, we'll see exactly what IBM means by minimize disruptions. There are other problems with this, primarily the idea that information is being gathered solely for the use of decision makers, when after all, the very meaning of democracy is that each of us in our own lives should ultimately be the decision makers with the responsibility for determining the shape of urban life. Cisco is the manufacturer of the internet routers that 60% of the traffic on the world's internet flows through. They obviously have a lot to be gained by a dramatic intensification of the networking and technologization of the everyday urban environment. Cisco describes their comparable effort as the seamless integration of public and private services delivered across a common network infrastructure to individuals, governments, and businesses. Well, that individuals, governments, and businesses strikes me as being about the right order of priority. But, you know, there are other issues with this as well. That seamless in particular. Anytime you hear somebody use the word seamless in the technological context, I want you to put brackets around it and remember that that word is a lie. Because digital information technological networks are inherently heterogeneous. They are inherently seamful. They do not connect seamlessly. They cannot connect seamlessly. Anybody promising to offer you a seamless experience is lying to you. Siemens has this very aggressive definition. They describe the smart city as a place and a time several decades from now where cities will have countless autonomous, intelligently functioning IT systems that will have perfect knowledge of users' habits and energy consumption and provide optimum service. The goal of such a city is to optimally regulate and control resources by means of autonomous IT systems. Well, first of all, perfect knowledge is a phantasm. It's a fantasy. I cannot quite conceive that anybody was unwary enough to argue that there would ever be a technological system capable of having perfect knowledge of everything. But the more disturbing part about this definition is that thing about the goal. Do cities have goals? What is Prague's goal? How could anything as multi-voiced and multi-vocal and multi-sided and heterogeneous as a city ever have a single unitary goal? What is Cleveland's goal or Karachi's goal or Seoul's goal? It's nonsensical to speak of a city having goals. Living Planet, interestingly enough, describes their smart city as a complete picture of building state usage and operations continually maintained, allowing constant, there's that word again, optimization of energy resources, environment, and occupant support and convenience systems. So this language should terrify us. This is a company that's capable of taking everything beautiful and meaningful and valuable about a city, everything that generates experience and memory, and thinking of it as occupant support and convenience systems, like it was some kind of air conditioning duct on a space station. This should worry us that these people are proposing to intervene in our cities. But of course, Living Planet also describes the smart city as the missing link between the real estate and technology sectors. And here I think finally we're being honest. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the smart city. For whom is the smart city being developed? Well, I think we can see from these definitions that it is a thoroughly technocratic vision. The smart city aims on a cleared site on a place where there was no city before, no people before, to impose an essentially optical order that is dedicated to the needs of watchfulness from above and consecrated to the prerogatives of administration. This is what IBM built for the city of Rio de Janeiro. This is the Intelligent Operations Center, a $40 million fusion center that runs all of the operations of the city of Rio de Janeiro, where all of that information is brought into one place and rendered in visualizations, which are then turned around for the exclusive use of the city's administrators. Well, anybody who knows anything about information technology knows that once you've gathered that information, you could turn around and reoffer it to the world through what is called an API, an application programming interface, at essentially zero cost. And since offering that information back out to the public would cost little or nothing, and IBM has chosen not to do it, what that suggests to me is that they don't believe that, in fact, we as members of the public ought to have access to that information. This is a similar center that Cisco built for Abu Dhabi. This is a member of the Abu Dhabi police. Cisco's ambition is to put an IP camera, an internet protocol capable network camera, over every building entrance in the city of Abu Dhabi and have the police watching at all times. What is the why of all of this activity? Well, this screenshot ought to give us a clue. This is the back end. This is a visualization from the back end of a system called Kiviti that is developed by a French company the company is called Kiviti, which in Latin means who watches. This is exactly what the smart city is all about. This is a video camera that is applying an index of 81 different metrics to each face it sees and attempting to characterize that person walking by the camera as to their age, their gender, their ethnicity, and by bouncing light off of their eyeballs and measuring the reflectivity of that light, whether or not they're paying attention to a billboard. The goal of the smart city, in one sentence, is the computational extraction of value from everyday activity. But I would argue not merely the extraction of value, but the preservation of that value for a very small minority, not value that is shared with those of us who are generating it. Another goal of the smart city is to optimize resource utilization and, of course, to minimize disruption. It is to take those of us who constitute the multitude as a material. The smart city has no way of accounting for these very salient activities, which make up so much of the meaning and culture of cities on Earth. It has no way of accounting for activities like informal housing, or practices of informal mobility, or the delivery of informal services. And if you think that these illustrations of the informal sector do not apply to Prague, you may be mistaken. The World Bank acknowledges that informal economic activities were responsible for something like 30% of GDP worldwide through the years 1999 to 2007. So we ought to be concerned about a model of economic activity that does not account for the informal sector at all. The smart city has no way of accounting for these other very salient activities, these that we recognize from all over the world, from Tahrir Square to Madrid to Zuccotti Square, to a very small version of Occupy in Dublin, to the protests that took place in Montreal, to those that took place in Taksim Square, in Istanbul, and in Sao Paulo. As a matter of fact, the smart city conceives of the practice of democracy as disruption. That is precisely what IBM means when they say minimize disruptions. They mean minimizing the practice of democracy. Lest you think that I'm simply an embittered leftist academic saying this, I want you to realize that this is exactly what IBM themselves say explicitly in their developer guidelines for the Intelligent Operation System manual. In that manual, they have questions like this: which streets will require the most troops, armed, militarized police, to suppress incidents of democracy? These are the police in question. This is the Special Operations Police Battalion of Rio de Janeiro, a police force that's been cited by Amnesty International with multiple violations of human rights abuses and civil liberties. This is the smart city. What subjectivity is the smart city intended to reproduce? What vision of everyday life is encompassed by it? Well, in the smart city, in the marketing materials that these vendors offer us, we see a very clear and consistent vision of what everyday life in the smart city is to be like. It is to be a lifestyle of consumption, convenience, and security. But it is a lifestyle of consumption, convenience, and security only for a very few, and a permanent state of exception for everyone else. Take, for example, Masdar in Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi is a place where 79.6% of the population and a full 90% of the labor force are foreign guest workers whose passports are taken from them upon arrival, who have effectively no rights at all, neither civil rights nor human rights, who are subject to every kind of abuse. So when you see a picture like this one of Masdar City, you should remember that the people who built it, and again, 79.6% of the population, live in places like this. Shipping containers, unsheltered from the desert sun, surrounded by razor wire and fences and armed private security guards. It's also incontrovertible that the smart city, in its planning practices, in its physical provision for the built environment, recapitulates some astonishingly prominent blunders of the 20th century, things that those of us who are architects or urban planners all learned about in our first year of school. What were these blunders of high modernist urban planning in the 20th century? Well, these were cities that were built on cleared greenfield sites. Remember, Le Corbusier, the prime architect of high modernism in the 20th century, is somebody who is capable of looking at Paris and thinking of it as little more than a collection of donkey's paths that ought to be swept away. The terrain ought to be cleared so we could build something of value upon that land. These were places where residence was segregated from commerce, which was segregated from industry, and all of these things were segregated from the systems of circulation that bind the city together. These were places, ultimately, they're about a model of optical clarity consecrated to the needs of administration and with no way of accounting for informality. And if this is starting to sound familiar, well, there's that old line about those who forget history being condemned to repeat it. And that is precisely what we are doing. Consider the primary high modernist failures of planning of the 20th century. Places like Brasilia, clearly designed in the shape of a raptor, a bird of prey, or Chandigarh in India. Both of these administrative centers consecrated to the needs of their administrators with rigorous functional segregation, and both of them utter failures. Both of them notorious failures that if the designers of the smart city knew anything about the history of 20th century urbanism, they would be taking great pains to avoid. Instead, in places like Masdar and Songdo and Planet Valley in Portugal, the designers of the smart city are recapitulating these precise errors, making these same blunders over and over and over again. But that's not even my real problem with the smart city. The real problem with the smart city is that as a discourse, it has nothing to do with cities. It treats our urban environments as terrain or a market. It speaks of these bizarre ideas like the fact that a city might have a goal, or that everything that gives meaning and value and texture and resonance to our lives might simply be an occupant support and convenience system. Ladies and gentlemen, I remind you, this is the smart city, something that is utterly predicated on a neoliberal political economy, something that is disturbingly consonant with the exercise of authoritarianism and control from the top down, something that is evacuated of content, evacuated of history, evacuated of politics. I would argue to you, evacuated of urbanity itself. But the good thing about its being a discourse and a rhetorical production is that if it is only that, it is not an inevitability. It is just one selection from the sheaf of techno-social possibilities that are available to us. What I'm interested in, and what I believe that we ought to be building together, is not a smart city at all, but a conscious, aware, and loving practice of networked urbanism, which is to say that of the great 20th century urbanists, my model is not this man, is not Le Corbusier, it is this woman, Jane Jacobs, in The Death and Life of Great American Cities, written in 1961. And if I ask myself what it is that we should be doing with emerging technologies in the urban environments of the planet, my recourse is to this question: what would Jane Jacobs do? I believe that she would be interested in systems that underwrite the city's existing intelligence, the city's existing intelligence, which is to say our collective intelligence, our existing competence for being urban people in urban places, everything that we know about how to live and give meaning to the city. Jane Jacobs would argue that order arises spontaneously from below when it is allowed to, in a way and in a process that takes advantage of all that messy history, precisely. The history of a place that both Le Corbusier and the architects of the smart city would sweep aside entirely. She would say that order is something built up over time by an infinity of small acts. And that is why when we speak about data-driven urbanism or networked cities, I think we need to ask ourselves questions about provenance, data. You know, I literally heard an IBM senior data scientist say to me once, the data is the data, neutral, objective, unimpeachable. Nonsense. Nonsense. How could somebody rise to the position of a senior data scientist and believe that? The data is never just the data. There is no such thing as raw data. Somebody made the data. So if we are going to design smart cities that truly respond to the conditions of our lives, we need to be asking ourselves, who made that data? Who gathered it? How can we as citizens gain access to it? And what can we as communities, as collectives, and as individuals do with it? Most importantly of all, we need to be asking, what does this work make of us? We need to have a different set of values guiding our work. Now, I have tried to make the values that are inscribed in the smart city explicit, so I think it's only fair that I be explicit about the set of values that I bring to my work, and these are my values. I believe that in setting out to design the technologized cities of the 21st century, we must ensure that where the public generates data, it has meaningful access to and ownership of that data. I believe we ought to be resisting concentrations and asymmetries of network-derived power knowledge. I believe that we ought to be preventing capture of the commons by private interest, and above all, I believe that we need to inscribe a robust conception of the right to the city in all of the city's networked objects, services, and relations. If there is such a thing as the smart city, ladies and gentlemen, I believe that we can do better, much, much better. If anything I've said has piqued your interest, whether you agree with it or very strongly disagree with it, I encourage you to read more in the pamphlet I published last year, perhaps unsurprisingly entitled Against the Smart City. And I thank you very, very much for your time, your attention, your voices. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
Okay, that was Adam Greenfield from August 2020. That was uploaded. Speaking at a conference. He's based at the London School of Economics, and he's talking a lot of common sense to me. What he's saying does make sense. It's like the embedded assumptions within the idea of the smart city that are the issue. We need to make them visible and have a discussion about them. And there was one more that I was listening to this morning, when I was trying to find material for the show, and it was a woman who'd resigned from a smart cities project in Canada, and I can't seem to see it at the moment, but here we go, the sidewalk woman. So this is a woman, I think it's Toronto, the project, Sidewalk Labs, was contracted to put together a smart city project for the Quayside. Let me take that back to the beginning again. And Sidewalk Labs is part.
My name is Anne Kavukian, and I resigned in protest from the Sidewalk Labs Smart City project.
Anne Kavukian is the former Privacy Commissioner of Ontario. She was hired by Sidewalk Labs to develop a privacy framework for their Smart City project on Toronto's waterfront.
Sidewalk Labs is an Alphabet company, and they are creating smart cities. And they bid on the smart city that was being proposed in Toronto, and they succeeded at that. So when they approached me because they said they wanted me to embed privacy by design into the smart city they wanted to create for Toronto. There was going to be tech everywhere, 24/7, sensors and cameras and everything to capture all the activities in the smart city, in the city that was taking place, so that they could help you get from point A to point B and get you information. But you can imagine, if you have all these sensors and this tech on 24/7, it's going to collect a lot of personal information, which the citizens aren't going to want. So I wanted to embed privacy by design into the whole smart city in order to prevent the privacy harms from arising.
Anne presented Sidewalk Labs with a list of recommendations to ensure privacy as a foundation for the proposal.
So my main suggestion after I studied this for a while was we had to embed privacy into everything. We had to de-identify data at source. And what I meant was whenever the camera or the sensor or whatever tech picks up some occurrence, people driving, people walking on the street, whatever. Whenever it picks up any data, the minute it picks up the data, you strip it of all personal identifiers. You strip it of the license plate numbers on the cars, etc., so that you will still have a massive amount of data, but none of it will be privacy invasive because there won't be any personally identifiable data associated with it. No personal identifiers. See, that's what privacy is all about. You can have a ton of data. If it's not linked to personal identifiers that can be associated with an individual, then you have data, but there's no privacy risk. So that's why I insisted upon all data being collected, being de-identified at source. And it was great. Sidewalk Labs went along with that at the beginning.
But Sidewalk Labs would be the only entity to have control over the data, a fact that didn't sit well with some privacy experts and civic leaders who criticized their plans.
So in response to this, Sidewalk Labs decides to create an urban data trust, which will consist of all of the parties involved in creating the smart city, not just Sidewalk Labs, but Waterfront Toronto, the provincial government, federal government, and all of the companies who are going to be delivering the tech, the IT companies, et cetera, to pull this together. That would have been fine, but when they announced it at a board meeting, they said, and of course, we will encourage all the companies to de-identify data at source, but we have no control over what they do. In effect, we can't make them do that. And the minute they said that, I knew that it was over. Because once you say it's voluntary, it's not going to happen. Everyone wants personally identifiable data. And that's what was so upsetting to me, that they, on their own, decided to do this, knowing how upsetting it would be to me, and that, in my view, privacy would go down the drain. So I couldn't tolerate that. The next morning, I resigned.
The project pressed forward, but continued to face concerns from citizens and city officials. Then in May 2020, in the midst of the pandemic, Sidewalk Labs abandoned development of the smart city.
Well, you know, it was part of the COVID world. And they said, we just don't think this is going to proceed. Everything has changed. It was nonsense. They just didn't know how they were going to do this in a way that protected privacy and delivered services. And remember, Waterfront Toronto was the body that was running all of this. And all of a sudden, Waterfront Toronto is saying, no, we're with Ankavukian on this. You must de-identify data at source. And they're saying, how are we going to do that with these companies? Anyway, it became such a mess for them that they felt it was easier just to back out.
Smart cities will eventually be built in Canada, but Anne urges us to decide carefully if we want a city of surveillance or a city of privacy.
I'm on the International Council of Smart Cities, and I can tell you, all of the smart cities coming out in the Far East, Dubai, etc., they're all smart cities of surveillance. They know exactly what you're doing, where you're going. It would be a nightmare for me to live in a city like that. And, you know, one of the things I had said to Sidewalk Labs early on is, let's develop a model smart city of privacy that we can then offer to others. Bill Gates wants to build a smart city in Florida. We can approach him and say, look, we've got the perfect model for this, and it protects privacy. It's a total win-win. I think we can still do that. We have to insist upon privacy being embedded into the smart cities. Otherwise, it will be a smart city of surveillance. And everything you do, all of your activities will be tracked, surveilled, the data exchanged with third parties unknown that you haven't consented to. Nightmare. We want to live in freedom. Privacy forms the foundation of our freedom. We have to do this. We can do this. We just need the will to do it.
Okay, that was a piece about the Toronto Smart Cities project on the waterfront. I thought it was quite interesting, and it ties in with the previous piece quite nicely. The interesting thing is that it was possible for Anne to get a reasonable way down the road to what she wanted to do, which means that it is possible. So to me, I think it's possible at a local level to embed privacy into smart cities. I'm going to see how far down the road Newcastle is, because I'm not sure how far down the road they are. So I'm going to take a look at what the council's doing and whether they've allocated contracts and what have you. I'll give me something to do tomorrow. I'll put it on my list of things to do tomorrow. It will be on my list also. That's all good. So I'm going to go through the list on the chat room now. Revolution Radio is listener supported. So if you do like what you're hearing, not just me, any of the hosts, we're all volunteers. And if you do like what you're hearing, we welcome donations. We welcome your support. You can find a place to make donations at revolution.radio, where you'll also find the chat room. And it's usually fairly active. It's been active this morning. There's about 30 people in there. It's usually about 10 or 15 people active at any one time. It's not so active that you can't follow the conversations, but there is still quite a reasonable amount of activity in there. So it's a nice balance of the two together. And you can find me on the internet in various places. My podcast, which is my main outlet at the moment, is on Podbean, and it's called Free Association Radio Show Podcast and Roundtable. On there, you can find it on Google Podcasts or on Spotify as well. If you're in those places, just wherever you listen to podcasts, you should be able to find the Free Association Radio Show Podcast and Roundtable version. I do a roundtable on Tuesday mornings my time, which is 4 o'clock in the morning East Coast time. It's the middle of the night basically, but I just about managed to get up in time to do it when I've been sleeping. I didn't sleep at all last Monday overnight. So I was ridiculously tired, and it was a bit of a dog's breakfast, but we got through 2 hours. The first hour was all right, and then there was all sorts of bits and pieces going on. And that meant it was a bit disjointed the second hour, but I was happy with the first hour, and there was some good content in there. It was a good round table. It was a good couple of people supporting it regularly. We're looking for more people to come on board on the round table. We normally talk about philosophy, psychology, sometimes some health stuff. It was health on Tuesday. And health took us into psychology and philosophy, inevitably. That's usually where we end up. No matter where we start, that's where we end up. But it's fun. It's nice and relaxed. It's been a COVID-free zone so far, and I'm thinking it'll probably stay a COVID-free zone. I don't mind going into COVID a little bit, but it's not the main topic of conversation. On the round table, it's an occasional topic of conversation, should we say, as is economics, as social issues or whatever. There's a range of things that we do talk about. But we always end up with philosophy and psychology. So that's pretty much it. I'm going to go down the visitors list and say hello to people. So we've got in the chat room, we've got Not Much To It, Azra, WSOD, Zog, Journeyman Jack, Lady Horse. We've got AR185162, OE McVeigh, Pagan Rabbit, Tootsie, Monster383, Dryfly Guy, Valerie, Boo Boo Fan, and it goes on and on like that. So it's a good bunch of people. As I say, there's usually a reasonably active chat room in here, and you can make a contribution just by being in the chat room. There's no reason necessarily to make a money donation. You can do anything you want to do, in effect. That's enough for me. I'll be back next week at the same time, and I'll be speaking to Mitzi next week. With all being well, we'll see you then.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Be evasive. But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. And there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Wow.
What the heck is the truth, jihad? Hey, I'm Kevin Barrett, host of Truth Jihad Radio. Federal prosecutors, Department of Homeland Security agents, and curious passersby often ask me, just what is this truth jihad thing anyway? Well, everybody knows what truth is, but jihad is a misunderstood term. Jihad means effort or struggle. The greater jihad is the struggle to be a better person, while the lesser jihad is the struggle to defend the community. Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, did say that the best jihad is a word of truth flung in the face of a tyrant. And that's what we do here at Truth Jihad Radio! Every Friday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Pacific, right here on Revolution Radio!